header on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
It makes me now get to go wonder how many Rolling Stone songs I have on my phone. Did we get your guilty pleasure song that you wouldn't want people to know is on your phone?
I thought we were saving that for later.
Well, we'll play it with Evan next time he's on, but I didn't want to admit to him. I'll admit to all of you that there is one Kelly Clarkson song on my phone, but you know, but now it's your turn.
See, because I don't download a whole lot of music to my phone. I listen to Spotify, so I stream it. But I do.
God, here we go with the generational.
I know
thing
it's
again.
It is a thing.
Don't own any music.
I do own. That's not true. For the artists that I love the most, like my favorite band, The Wonder Years. Every time they come out with an album, I go and buy it because I know that the streaming revenue that they get off of Spotify, Apple Music, all of those things is minuscule to the amount of times that I'm actually going to listen to it. I need to go and buy it. So I do go out and purchase CDs still. It's harder and harder to find places to play those CDs, but my laptop doesn't even have
a
CD.
Hey, Grandpa,
port.
Even I don't have CDs anymore. I download things and own them.
Okay, that's fair. But I go and buy
the
record.
The Wonder Years, not to be confused with the Wonders, who do
correct.
That thing you do.
Correct.
From the Tom Hanks movie.
Correct.
Did you see
the
that
one? I have not seen
the one hit wonder movie. It's really good. Put that on your list.
All right. And Brian always catches me up because Brian has these 80s and 90s references that just go right over my head since I was a wee young lad in the 90s. I will admit to having an Ariana Grande playlist on my Spotify that I do listen to from time to time. My fiance is a big Ariana Grande fan, and she has converted me. So I can jam out to pretty much any Ariana Grande song because I hear it enough that I've become a fan. I have become a fan.
Well, I tell you, I feel a lot less guilty about having one Kelly Clarkson song now, on my phone. But sometimes you just need to put on Since You've Been Gone and put it up to 11.
There you go.
And you're a drummer. I like that one, especially for the drums.
There's a cover of that song by a band that I really like that does an excellent job with it, but it's more of a...
The Wonders?
No. It's a hard rock version of Since You've Been Gone, and I do like the drumming in that one.
See, I would like to hear that because I do like, you know, some people don't like remakes. I don't like remakes so much as reimagining something. And, like Don Henley's Boys of Summer was redone by, now those senior moments are coming up. It was redone a couple of years back and, you know, did a very nice job. And I would listen to that one.
The Ataris redid the Boys of Summer.
Ataris, thank you. Yes. We are going to be talking to Angela Lang coming up in our next segment here about Black leaders organizing communities, talking about, you know, the work that they're doing in Milwaukee. We'll talk a bit about the race for governor and what people around the state need to know about organizing their friends and neighbors to, you know, cast an informed vote. But I couldn't help but note this morning, because I am an early riser, that it was a little darker than I would have liked, and came to appreciate that the sun is no longer rising before 6 a.m. and will not rise before 6 a.m. again. I had to look up the date here, April 28th of next year.
Oh, that hurts. That hurts so much.
It does. It really does. Because I'm the one every year that when people complain in the spring about daylight saving time, I remind them that if we didn't have that, you know, it's not that the sun would be coming up before 6. The sun would be coming up before 5. If we didn't, you know, move those clocks ahead. So I'm rather happy with the way that the clock is set up right now. I would keep daylight saving time for good if, you know, because again, at this latitude, who needs the sun to be directly above you at noon? And by the way, I'm sorry, I offended the three of you who still use a sundial, you know, and maybe even have the sundial watch like Fred Flintstone, you know, used to have. And if you did, I'm sorry, but nobody else needs the sun to be directly overhead at noon. So we can move that ahead. The problem is we're a country that, stretches quite a bit north to south. And, you know, in the southern part of the country, they don't need that. Again, from, you know, living on an island for a time down at that latitude, It really doesn't matter at all. Sunrise and sunset are almost always 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. with just, you know, very little variance from that. You know, contrast that with, you know, living at the poles where you might actually you have some 24-hour days and some 24-hour nights. So it'd be great if you could, if we could like split the country along, say, the Mason-Dixon line or something, and say, you know, below this, you guys don't have to do daylight saving time, but above it, you know, we need to keep that. But if only there were some way to keep that 6 a.m. sunrise or pre 6 a.m. sunrise just a little bit longer, you know, make summer last just a little bit longer, because when that sunset happens at about 4 p.m, oh, that's just sad, man.
It is. And that is one of those things. And my biggest pet peeve is people are like, oh, I love summer, the days are getting longer. And I'm like, no, the days are getting shorter once summer's officially here. and mornings like this morning are tough to realize that all of a sudden you don't get that pre 6 a.m. sunrise.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's theater seasons. We know how this rolls. We do the best we can. We appreciate what we have. And so that was my moment of appreciation for a nice early sunrise. But hey, we just move on to other seasons, other phases. It's still election season. Angela Lang knows that pretty well from Block. We'll talk to her about Black leaders organizing communities when we come back. You're up north. Well, look who found the Ataris. Thank you for reminding me of who that was that did the remake of Don Henley's Boys of Summer. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow, and I'm joined now by Angela Lang of Block, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, and by their on their own website, you'll see them say that they provide the tools, training, and resources to help Milwaukee's Black community build long-term political power. We're going to talk about what that means. How does it happen? And then, you know, how do we take those lessons in, you know, say a rural district of Wisconsin? What are the parallels to take away? Because in both cases, as I learned from serving, you know, with legislators from Milwaukee, we both have kids that need educations that come from low income areas. Well, we both need the roads, you know, to be smooth and work. So let's try to look for those parallels and build some bridges. Angela, nice to see you here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I do want to learn more about, you know, Block from square one for folks that are not familiar with it. But we are, of course, this week, you know, reacting to the primary election results. We're heading into the general election campaign. We know that, you know, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes was active in the community before he was in the legislature, before he was Lieutenant Governor, before he became the, you know, the state Democratic nominee for the United States Senate. And yet, you know, the questions come up repeatedly about that magic word electability in a state that is, you know, has so much large rural white areas. And I love your Twitter feed, and I love that you went to it and said, "Can we get rid of that word now?" Why'd you say that?
Yeah, I think some of my frustration is hearing people only refer and have this conversation about electability only when it comes to Black candidates. And let's be honest, we know the demographics of our state. You know, there's Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin, and then it feels like there's the rest of the state. And I think a lot of folks feel that if you're only catering to Milwaukee, which largely is code for only catering to Black and brown people, that is a losing message and is not a message that'll resonate across the rest of the state. And so for me, you know, seeing that be kind of an excuse as to not support a Black candidate, we kind of see that electability is seen as the new dog whistle. And you know, we see someone like Dr. Kaz Bowers over at All In Wisconsin that is talking about that, that is saying this is the new dog whistle in Wisconsin. And so, you know, for me to see people, not only like Lieutenant Governor Barnes advance to the primary for the Senate, but also you see people like Darren Madison as well, who be a strong candidate, the mayor of Glendale, to be a state representative. And so this kind of concept of electability, which we only have when we're talking about Black candidates, seems to now be debunked, and people need to find another reason to not support Black candidates and can't use the guise of electability anymore.
Talking to Evan Goyke last hour, and he was saying that it was actually a good week for a couple of assembly races and for the mm-hmm. sheriff's race, I gather, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we see a history-making moment with the sheriff here in Milwaukee. We have elected now our first Black woman to be sheriff. And so I think there's just all of these different examples of how Black folks are actually having a seat at the table, are able to build long-term political power and to have this representation. And I know that probably makes some folks uncomfortable. It's a change. But at the same time, representation is so important. As, you know, Mandela says, if you want to change DC, you have to change the people that we send to DC. And I think being able to have that lived experience with representation also matters.
Do feel free to push back on this as a middle-aged white guy in northern Wisconsin. I understand I'm not drawing a direct parallel, other than to say that, you know, the whole electability buzzword was really bandied about in 2012 when Tammy Baldwin was running for U.S. Senate. And, oh, can this, you know, lesbian from Madison, you know, elite, blah, 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 really represent us? Mm-hmm. And, you know, she won somewhat narrowly and then really, really proved herself. And again, I'm not mm-hmm. saying apples and apples necessarily, but I've certainly known Mandela Barnes well enough to see the parallel of how he can follow that Tammy Baldwin track and have a lot of people go, this guy's not what I thought, and I'm really liking this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, you know, Senator Baldwin's race in 2012. I remember how excited I was, and I was in college, and I had been following her career before then. And I think, you know, hearing that electability, that was the first time I heard about it. Like, oh, well, can she, you know, it'll be history making, it's groundbreaking. Is Wisconsin ready? I think is a lot of kind of the conversations. And then to hear, you know, not only Senator Baldwin win, but also to see her reelection in 2018. I remember the midterms that night, and I feel like they called Tammy Baldwin's race in about 7 or 8 minutes while the rest of us stayed up till about 1 or 2 in the morning until they decided the gubernatorial race. And I think, you know, the reflections off of that is that change sometimes makes people uncomfortable. You know, we're living in such polarized times that are we actually able to live our values, but not do it at the expense of, well, we just need to win by any means necessary. And I think sometimes the winning by any means necessary means compromising our values, having a watered down message, you know, going away from things that are like Black Lives Matter that for some reason are seen as controversial. But I think for us, we need to be pushing ourselves and our candidates and, you know, folks in the Democratic Party to continue to make these changes and these strides, because we don't have a conversation now about talking about if Tammy Baldwin, the first LGBTQ senator from Wisconsin, we don't have that conversation if she's electable anymore, because we've overcome that.
Exactly. But in that sad school of winning by any means possible, we pointed out to our audience a few days back that there was this ad running with 5 very angry sounding, very scared looking white people. And they were all holding up, you know, a square, you know, kind of a green screen effect. And in there were the images that, you know, are coming. There's Kenosha on fire. There's the Waukesha parade tragedy. There's, you know, any type of riots. And again, that was not put forward by actual crime victims with actual concerns. It turns out it was a nonprofit group affiliated with the Republican Governors Association, who will do whatever is possible to try to, you know, get Tim Michaels across the finish line and defeat Tony Evers. And I can't imagine how tiring it is to have to fight this every time. But I look back at one of your lines saying that you compared 2020 to being stuck in the game of Jumanji, where every time you turn around, there's another challenge. But I got to think, other times you turn around and it's the same old challenge, the same old imagery, the same old stereotypes that you have to, you know, take aim at.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought that up because I know exactly what ad you're talking about. Our team is very familiar with that ad, and we definitely cringe every time we see it, and we can't help but to notice that it is largely white folks. And what does that mean? What is the message that we're sending? And, you know, I think there's a lot of us that saw this coming. You know, we were like, Kenosha and the Waukesha tragedy are going to be exploited. The pain and the trauma is going to be exploited for political gain. And I think a lot of us organizers have been talking about it for a year plus. We know the ads are going to get nasty. They're going to get real racist real fast. You know, we already saw some of those dog whistles, and I can imagine that they're going to happen even more. We've seen, you know, some Freudian slips these days where both yes. Former Governor Scott Walker and another member of the Republican Party both kind of made these gaffes in referring to both Mandela Barnes and to current Senator Cory Booker. And instead of calling them radical, they used the word racial. And there was like, oh, that was
quite a typo.
A wrong word to use. And that's what I said. I was like, that's quite a bit of a screw up there. And I think that really kind of is very telling of some of the ads that we're going to see, but also how they truly feel. They're saying the quiet parts out loud.
So, look, there will be that effort to, I mean, let's call it what it is, you know, scare white voters in rural areas. And that is not necessarily your battle. So I want to ask your, you know, your reaction to it, that battle is going to be out there all across, you know, northern Wisconsin. But where Block's power really is working in your own backyard. And again, you talk about the tools, the training and the resources to build long term political power. What does that mean? And how does that happen?
Yeah. So for us, you know, we're definitely focused on trying to focus on our community the most, community that have been left behind. So we currently have Milwaukee, Racine, and Kenosha is where we have our base right now. And for us, it starts by building a sense of community, by knocking on doors, listening to issues, but then also being able to be a tool and a resource for folks. As our ambassadors are out there knocking in the field, they're able to say, hey, do you know that we have a state Supreme Court race coming up in the spring? Do you know that they're 10-year terms? These are the reasons that we should care. So having those kind of long-term engagements and having this year-round focus is incredibly important. But at the same time, we do understand that while we're focused on our own community, there is very valuable relationships and partnerships that can be had in the rural community as well, because we understand, as you mentioned, what keeps us safe. We understand that we all want good schools. We all want a livable wage job. We all want to be able to thrive. And I think even though we're only focusing on our community, we see that that message is actually very much broader, and that connects with a lot of rural folks as well, too.
Angela Lang is here from Block, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. And in talking about what you do, I'm hearing parallels to our conversation last week with Robert Craig from Citizen Action and other groups that I refer to as democracy's little helpers, because it's no longer enough just to wait every other year for a candidate or a political party to come along. This is year-round work now to convey the importance of issues, to convey the sense of community. At least we think that's what has to happen. The question is it working? Do you feel like this was the right path and that this does pay dividends in the end?
Absolutely. Our model, by being able to have kind of this for us, by us model, and then not going away after every election cycle, really allows us to build deep trust in a community that has been left behind politically. And people really see us as their kind of political and organizing home. And so I really do feel that the only way to actually make this kind of work long term and to be sustainable is to have that year round focus. We can't kind of go away and then try to come back later and say, hey, remember me from 2 years ago or 4 years ago. We're not building relationships. And it's also very transactional, and we want to disrupt that. So absolutely, I'm proud of our model, and I think it works.
Now, there is the potential, and I'm not trying to stir up trouble here, but it just might, when you have essentially hometown groups, and then we've always heard about how people, whether it's parties, national parties, other people, they parachute people in to come and, you know, talk to you. I certainly experienced that, you know, up in this part of the state where I had one message, but suddenly a group that said they were allied with me was knocking on doors and saying something that, you know, wasn't completely the same verse in the same hymnal. Has that been a concern as well over the years?
I think that's always a concern. What I'm seeing now is that I think folks are finally starting to get the message. You kind of can't do that. And so national groups that do want to come in and support specifically Black organizing, they're talking to us. Hey, we want to knock doors here. Let's coordinate on message. What are the issues? And so we're starting to see people understand that they can't just parachute in. And same with the Democratic Party. I have a really good relationship with the chairman, Ben Wickler, and we're able to chat wherever legally allowable. But also at the same time, they have also been building long-term as well. And I think they also understanding having a more neighborhood local model that is on a year-round basis.
There's a whole lot of listening going on, which is well overdue. Angela Lang is our guest. We will take this break and talk more about Black leaders organizing for communities next. You're up north.
From Lake Wasota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow. Take off the slow.
Back down to Thursday morning with Angela Lang from Block, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. We've been talking about the work that they do. Angela, I wanted to ask, you know, in terms of why you do it and come back to something you wrote for us in an op-ed 2 years ago now. And you talked about watching the homecoming for John Lewis. And you said, as I watched his casket cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge for the final time, I couldn't help but feel like he was passing the baton to our generation to continue his legacy. That is at the same time as inspirational as it had to be frightening that you felt the responsibility that's on you now.
Yeah, I do this work because it's so personal. I've always kind of been built in this way where I can't just be quiet. If I have an opinion about something, I kind of just have to speak on it. But I think, you know, understanding over the years, it's weird to say this because I just turned 33, but I've been doing this work for 15 years, and there are times I get burnt out and there are times I want to quit, but my spirit is restless. Just let me sit back while literally the world is burning and I feel like I need to do something about it. And I remember watching that funeral and watching it and just how emotional I felt. I did not have the good fortune of being mentored by him like some colleagues I know, but I did meet him and has followed his work and understanding the civil rights era and what the lessons that we can learn now. And I think there's a lot that we're seeing and a lot of parallels. And so for me, I do this work because I love Milwaukee. I love this state. I love democracy. And I feel like sometimes as Black women, those things don't love us back. And so it feels like a bit of a tug of war and kind of a little bit of a battle, but one that I don't feel like I can sit out.
And a good thing too, because there are plenty of people on the other side of the political spectrum that are staying busy and who find little ways and tactics and messages and things that tend to get in the way of the work you're doing. And the whole reason you wrote that op-ed for us back then was this was when Kanye West was, threatening to run, missed the deadline in Wisconsin by like 5 seconds or whatever it was. But you pointed out that this was part of a larger issue. You know, the Black community is not monolithic like any other. There are, Donald Trump actually grew, his percentage of the Black vote reportedly. It's a diverse world in any sector that we're talking about. And yet that has to be, given what we just talked about with John Lewis, somewhat maddening to see that it isn't just, fat old white guys like Donald Trump who are getting in your way.
Yeah, the anniversary of that op-ed was just like a day or two ago. So just a couple of days. And it came up in my Facebook memories and Twitter and whatnot. And I was like, wow, what a strange time. I wrote a whole op-ed about Kanye West running for president. Like, that's a very different time and not an op-ed I ever thought I'd have to write. But at the same time, I I'm always reminded, again, kind of going back to the civil rights era, Dr. Martin Luther King, everyone loves to quote him when it's convenient. So, you know, people kind of make the performative quotes on his birthday and whatnot. But he has a quote and from the letter of Birmingham Jail talking about the white moderate, and specifically folks that may not be in the pointy white hoods, but people that also may be obstructing progress. And I think these days that will be translated into, you know, the white liberals or the white progressives that are a little problematic or not need more areas to grow in terms of race and understanding their role in white supremacy. And so even within our own movements, and you know, I think that was really displayed with the campaigns, within our own movements, we have work to do, seeing either campaigns or supporters of campaigns kind of have these dog whistles when it came to, you know, Mandela Barnes goes to show that there's so much education and so much that we need to do specifically on our side as well. You don't need to wear a pointy white hood to uphold white supremacy these days. We need to constantly evaluate you know, our own role and how we're uplifting that. And that even comes within our own movement and in our own party and on our side of the aisle as well.
Well, I think as well for, let's say, you know, rural white progressives in trying to convey, you know, messaging properly to our neighbors out here. Mm-hmm. One of the great difficulties is conveying the notions of privilege and systemic racism, something that has a historic legacy, without triggering this gag reflex of somebody saying, "Pat, I am not a racist. Stop calling, you know, you can't call me a racist. You can't call me privileged. I work hard. I don't have any privilege." You don't, you have privilege. And it's sometimes painful to explain it. And I'm wondering if a lot of us are either going about it the wrong way and trying to explain why these issues are important. It's not that we're looking to tear you, my white rural neighbor, down to get there. This is not a zero-sum game.
I was just about to say, it's not a zero-sum game. You know, they're, instead of fighting each other for slices of the pie, we need to come together and go to the pie makers and say, build a bigger pie so that there's enough for us all. But I think we've operated, and, you know, there's systems that have been put in place that allow for us to operate in this way, but we operate from a very much scarcity mentality. You can't have this because it's taking something from me. And I think that that is pitting us against each other. It's pitting people that are marginalized and already hurting and disenfranchised against each other when we need to be coming together to go against what people think of like the 1% or, you know, things like that. I think about the Occupy movement and this 99% versus 1% and how that messaging, I think, was very, very strong. And how people, you know, urban and rural, this urban and rural divide that everyone loves to talk about, we are more alike than we are different. But sometimes race gets in the way from some of these conversations. But how do we kind of strip away some of that? And you know, one example I use is that I sometimes feel like I have a whole lot of other. I am a millennial, pansexual, Black woman. There's a whole lot of marginalization in there. But I also understand that I am cisgender. I am relatively financially stable. I am college educated. So there are these things that also make me privileged and understanding how can I tap into that in a meaningful way. And then where are there times that I need to be more vocal because of my lived experience is not being represented. And so I think being able to take a step back and understand that all of us are privileged in some way and all of us are marginalized in some way, in some ways more than others. And what does it look like to really come together around values? And I think that conversation is missing, but those conversations are hard when every direction we're told to be pitted against each other. But at the same time, as you mentioned, we all want good schools. We all want good jobs. We all want to, you know, provide for our family. If those are the values that we're starting with, how are we able to come together around those things and then also understand each other in other areas as well?
You know, Bill Clinton made it a cliche, you know, that I feel your pain. But, you know, the advice I have frequently given when having these kinds of conversations is that the first step is to acknowledge their own angst, you know, that people whose lives, you know, lifestyles others might be envious of who have a lot less. Those folks still have angst of one degree or another. They have concerns of one degree or another. And it comes back to what you're doing. It's those conversations, and you can't. it's not a conversation if you're talking past each other. It's actually listening and having a sense of empathy. And that has to work both ways, not just for, you know, again, rural white people, but, you know, blacks in big cities who may not appreciate what some rural families are going through that might, I don't know, lose their farm or their rural school might close or what have you. We have to have more of that listening.
Yeah. You know, one thing I always wanted to see, and I think sometimes this comes about with campaigns, but would love to see this outside of a campaign season, you know, next summer, even when there's no campaigns on the horizon, what does it look like to have a bus tour across the state? You stop in each congressional district and you just have a conversation. You have a diverse panel of folks from all over the state, if possible. But just to have that conversation, you know, people are struggling in every corner of the state, not just Milwaukee, not just southeastern Wisconsin. People are struggling in their own way. And so I think about how are we able to get into a room and to talk about these things. One thing I always wanted to see is that I want folks, you know, on farms to say, yes, I support Black Lives Matter. Even though I don't live there, I see injustice and that's not right because that is my fellow person. That's my fellow Wisconsinite. I want people in Milwaukee to care about the struggles of dairy farmers and what it means when prices are increasing and inflation and farmers are having more issues. How does that impact our community and our needs? And I want us to be able to have these conversations. And I think a lot of ways it's due to ignorance. And I think we say ignorance in like a bad way. Like there's this ignorant, you're ignorant. And you know, that's a harsh term, but there's also just like genuine ignorance of like, I have never, you know, been on a farm. I've gone to state fair. My family has some farms, but I personally have not been on a farm. And so I am ignorant in that regard, but what does it look like to have all of us sit down and to come together? And maybe we need to take it back to something that I did in middle school. We kind of did a school swap, which mm-hmm. kind of made me feel bad at the point. But, you know, we had a school that was not a part of the Milwaukee Public School District come in and shadow our team or our students. And they were like, oh, this is your art class. This is your gym. Oh, that's very different from my school. And they spent the day at our school. And then the next week we spent a day at their school. And I was like, you all get to ski? What is this like, right? And so we saw these conversations as kids of not only the disparities, but then also how we were different as individuals and how we were raised. And I think sometimes we just need to go back to that.
I could not possibly agree more. It was something we talked about during my time in the legislature, and I always regret that we couldn't make that happen. It's about helping people understand everybody. Everybody is, in fact, marginalized in some degree. For that dairy farmer, it might be the monopolies of the big, you know, agribusiness companies that are keeping their crop prices low. And I know some people would come back at that and say, oh, so you want everybody to feel like a victim. No, this isn't about a culture of victimhood. And whenever you're accusing somebody else of that, I mean, again, you're just demonstrating a lack of empathy for them. Everybody does have an area where they're marginalized. And all that means is they can use their voice, they can gather with other people, and as you said, make that pie a little bit bigger.
Yeah, I come from the school of organizing where we talk about strength in numbers, right? Instead of me being in my corner trying to fight for political power or a seat at the table, we're coming together. And that's part of the Block model, right? Is being able to have folks that understand and coming together. And we're organizing our community so we can have strength in numbers, but it's also important for other communities to work together. You know, whether it's Black and Brown communities, Milwaukee is incredibly segregated. So we need to make a point to continuously to be intentional with working together. And at the same time, we want to be intentional with working with other folks too, not in the city. And I think being able to have, I just keep harping on it, like having those conversations, I think is just the first step in order to do that. And it's not about, you know, people feeling like, oh, everyone should be a victim. No, we're all highlighting that we collectively are struggling in this way and we're pushing back. It's building people power. And I think it's actually the opposite of saying, oh, everyone's being a victim. We're putting people in a position of strength where people are coming together to demand the needs and to make sure that all communities across the state of Wisconsin are thriving, which is what we deserve.
we don't have enough time in there. It's not like anything's going to happen with voting rights additionally, sadly, although it should. So instead of voting rights and what things have gotten in the way, we'll end on just getting people to vote and making it easier on them, which I am sure is one of your big functions between now and November is helping people empowered, don't give up, actually register, actually vote.
Yeah, we got our work cut out for us. You know, we do that by knocking on doors, texting and phone banking and building those relationships, but also things like we have a back to school giveaway at the end of the month. So we're also kind of showing up as full people in order to have those deeper conversations and more meaningful conversations. But this election is about turning out as many people as possible, people that maybe only show up for presidential elections. It's going to come down to turnout and it's going to be very, very close, probably, is my assumption. And so all of us kind of all have a job to do, not just Block, but all of us got to take that extra time talking to a couple more family members and making sure they're coming out.
Oh yeah, because there isn't 100% voter turnout, which means there's always work to do. And Angela Lang is doing that from Block. Thank you so much. This was delightful, and I hope we get to talk again real soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, and we will wrap up the show next year up north.
Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, this is Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
On another gorgeous Thursday across Wisconsin. Here's the thing. Oh, there's our girl. It was cool. Now I feel like ordering something from Wayfair. Brewers win 4-3. Take both games against Tampa and have the day off before a critical three-game series at Busch Stadium against the St. Louis Cardinals. If you want to send us a note on how we're doing, the email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Tomorrow, former Chicago Tribune Metro editor Mark Jacob will be with us to talk about the state of media, state of American journalism. If you look at his Twitter feed at all, you know he doesn't think very highly of it. And since I'm 100% in agreement with him, we're going to have a good conversation on how we can turn to not all, but many a newsroom out there and say those do better. Also tomorrow, UWM professor Melissa Scanlon from the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. She's also a co-founder of Midwest Environmental Advocates. She will talk about the climate aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act and what kind of investments could result in some near-term gains. It is another one of those things that I have never, I just can't pretend to understand about people who will mock, you know, the Green New Deal and continue to say wrongly that you can't use green power if the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing. I mean, that is such a get a horse mindset, like, oh, the car is never going to catch on. The horse will be here forever. No. And there's all these jobs that we could have, should have created here. Building a high-speed rail line. We should be building more wind turbines. There are so many ways that you can grow jobs. You could also do it in biofuels. A lot of our paper mills that closed across Wisconsin could be turned into factories for making biodiesel and other things that make us less dependent on foreign energy sources. And instead, we have, you know, Tom Tiffany and other members of the congressional delegation and the legislative delegation mocking greener energy sources, mocking the economic development potential of it. Is that just because the campaign contributions are so good from the oil and gas side of things, or do they actually believe this stuff? You know, that, you know, you can't, one person can't fix it anyway, one country can't fix it anyway, so why even try? And as I've said with this analogy before and probably will many more times, you know, it's okay for me to stop peeing in Lake Wissota, even if I can't talk everybody else out of it. And with that, a lot of people now won't put their boat in the lake this week. I'm here to tell you, it's clean. It's got a lot of algae in it, but that's not my fault. That's, you know, that's cows and other things. So Luke was feeling left out that we didn't talk about food at all. He actually prepared for the show today.
Yeah, I brought snacks because I was...
You brought snacks. Did you bring something to share?
I would love to try to share some with you through the Zoom, but I don't know if I can send it that way. They're not digitally friendly, I guess.
No. So what kind did we get here?
I got the garlic and herb Colby Jack mix for the curds.
Garlic and herb Colby Jack mix.
Yep.
Okay.
Very, very good. Farmer John here in Dane County. I'm a frequent flyer of his stand. He goes to farmers markets all around the area, and he has, in my opinion, the best cheese curds that you can find locally.
So now is that an every Saturday thing at the Dane County Farmers Market?
He's been missing more Saturdays, but he goes to the Monona one on Sundays. He was at the Hilldale one yesterday, which is like right here next to the studios. So I was able to quickly leave and come back, and all of a matter of probably 5 minutes is all it took me to go get my curds yesterday. But I also have a plane bag for this weekend that I plan on eating, traveling to and from the state fair. So
you were able to disappear from the station for 5 minutes and come back.
And nothing completely melted down. It was very impressive. I was grateful.
That gets us back to our discussion of turntables. Because when I worked for WUEC, the radio station for the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, located in the Fine Arts Building on Water Street. And at that point in the early 80s, there was a McDonald's across the street. And we had educational programming, you know, during the day, but then, you know, student DJs could play all kinds of music at night. And so it won't surprise you to hear that I had an adult contemporary light rock shift on Tuesday afternoons from noon to three or something like that.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, long before there was Kelly Clarkson, there was Karen Carpenter. I mean, come on. Anyway, but sometimes it'd fill in at night, or what the night DJs would do if they were hungry and they needed to, you know, they wanted to run over to McDonald's, they would play, you know, there were a couple of different songs. And I just don't know if people make, you know, 13-minute songs anymore. But, you know, the joke is, you know, Stairway to Heaven. But for us, actually, it was the live version of Freebird.
I was going to say, there you go. Freebird was going to be my guess.
Oh, my goodness. Freebird. If you either had to go to McDonald's or you needed a longer break for some other reason, mm-hmm. That's what you would put on. And, you know, you very, very rarely, it was not impossible, not that song, but you would try some other longer song maybe, and you'd step out of the studio for a bit and you'd come back to that horrible, horrible sound. The record is skipping. And so the listeners have been hearing a record.
And you have no idea for how long.
You have no idea. Yeah. You know, so you come in, you move the needle, and you got to decide whether to, fess up to the listeners or not. So you had your different records that you would try. In the daytime, again, I mentioned that we had educational programming, and that was on great big reels, you know, your reel-to-reel tape decks that we had back at that point, again, all pre-digital. And you could always tell when a brand new, like a freshman, was a DJ at the college radio station, because that's where you started first. You didn't talk at all. You just ran the board and you would put these tapes on. And sometimes people would put the tape on and then think they could just leave after they, you know, hit play or what have you. What they didn't know was that when these, you know, 12-inch reels of educational programming came from various schools and distributors and things like that, they are fed to you what's called tails out. And all that means is you put the reel on and then you put on the take-up reel and you've got to rewind the whole thing and then play it from there so that when the program is done, it is back on the original reel. And then you send it back to the school or the distributor or whatever. More than once, somebody would forget that the reel was fed to you tails out. They would simply line it up. They'd leave the studio. You'd hear the station ID. And then you'd hear something like, which would last as long as it took for some very embarrassed student or a very angry, you know, senior to run back into the booth and fix these things.
Oh, geez. You made that sound very, very... That was a well rendition of backwards playing sound.
Well, I dabbled in a lot of satanic music.
Okay, fair enough.
So I really had to learn how to hide the lyrics as best we could. I want to thank again Angela Lang, Evan Goyke, and Congressman Mark Pocan for being our guests today. We will do this again tomorrow, still coming up with some kind of a pithy farewell saying. So for now, I'll just say, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.